Well, first of all, I don't know that I have the authority to do this, but on behalf of the family of public health, Michael, welcome. You are certainly one of us. With that formality out of the way, good morning. My name is Dr. Lucas Holler. I'm an assistant professor of public health at Nova Southeastern University. Before then, I served duty at being a professor of government at Stephen F. Austin State University and adjunct professor of public administration at Florida Atlantic University. So once I got brought into the public health program at Nova Southeastern University, the idea was to bring in an aspect of health administration. And with that being sort of a context for where I'm coming from, today what I'd like to speak to y'all about is this notion of initiating policy change in jurisdictions recalcitrant to conscious sex education, policy diffusion as a strategic model for the policy process. Perhaps Michael will appreciate the sincere policy aspects of the piece today. Hopefully they won't be too belaboring. That being said, of course, I have nothing to disclose. And what do we want to get out of today? What's the purpose for being here? Objectives. Notice my Bloom's taxonomy language here. First, explain multiple policy process models. Two, evaluate the usefulness of policy diffusion models of strategically promoting changes in health policy and policy development. And then lastly, this is a bit lofty of a goal. I'll leave this one for y'all once you leave the room. Design a policy change, policy development strategy that incorporates the policy diffusion model. So how are we going to accomplish these objectives? Well, the agenda first, just give you a quick overview of sex education in Florida, then present you with probably too many policy process models, but I think it's worth the while. And then secondly, focus specifically on the policy diffusion model and comprehensive sex education adoption in the state of Florida. And then lastly, discuss some of the potential utility of policy diffusion as a strategic approach to initiating policy change. Currently, the Florida state statutes require that schools teach abstinence only inside their sex ed and health classes, where they focus on nothing outside of marriage, and there's to teach the benefits of monogamous heterosexual marriage. As such, they're to emphasize abstinence from sexual activity as the certain way to avoid out-of-wedlock pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases. Additionally, in a different section of the statutes, when it comes to teach comprehensive health education, including life, that addresses an awareness of benefits of sexual abstinence as the expected standard and the consequences of teenage pregnancy. As such, the state of Florida, the Florida Department of Education, has identified four definitions of four different types of sex education. First, we have abstinence-only education, wherein it emphasizes absence of all sexual behaviors, and it may not include information regarding contraception, except for if you want to discuss failure rates of contraception, and you're not to talk about disease prevention methods. Now, moving a bit away from that rigid of the end of the paradigm, we also have something called abstinence only until marriage sex education, where we still emphasize abstinence outside of marriage, but here we have a little bit more leg room. We're still not going to talk about contraception except for failure rates, but we can talk about sex at least in the context of marriage, wherein it's the only morally correct form of sexual activity. Getting a little more progressive, we're pretty proud of ourselves. We have abstinence-based plus, or abstinence plus now, wherein we still emphasize the benefits of abstinence, but at least now we include information about non-coital sexual behavior, contraception, and disease prevention methods. If you were to ask the Florida Department of Education, how many counties in the state of Florida have comprehensive sex education, they will give you mostly ab plus. They won't actually talk about comprehensive sex education. And then finally, comprehensive sexuality education, they call it, is this notion of sex ed is a lifelong process wherein you talk about sexual development, reproductive health, what does it mean to have interpersonal relationships, affection, intimacy, talks about body image and gender roles, and it talks about abstinence as well, and of course, contraceptive options. Now, one of the tricks here, and any of y'all that are familiar with public school education for elementaries and high schools, one understands that it's organized in a very loose way. I forgot to mention at the beginning, from 2000 to 2002, I taught high school in an underserved public high school in South Carolina. And policy varies widely. We have a national level, and they can tell states to do some things, and then the states they can tell their districts to do some things, but all in all, the districts, and particularly the principals, have a lot of say in what goes on inside their schools. As such, whenever a school decides to implement a particular type of sex ed, we already identified four different types that they can use. In addition to that, there's no standard curriculum. So you end up, the school ends up choosing whatever curriculum, or the district tells the schools what to use, and these can be anything from nationally produced or locally produced, what they call mom and pop. And I have a little excerpt from a piece of curriculum used in Miami-Dade County Schools to talk to 7th and 8th graders about sex, and wherein they make some comparisons between males and females' approaches to sex. First, let's see. For males, becoming involved with girls is for sexual pleasure primarily. For females, they become involved with boys out of pursuit of love. Boys separate love and sex. Girls combine love and sex. More self-control. The boys use girls' hope for love to get sex. Girls use the boys' sex desires to get commitment, possibly pregnancy. And it goes on, wherein they continue to engender and instill sex role stereotypes, and they acknowledge the double standard, but kind of encourage it at the same time. We're letting the boys off the hook. So that's an example of a locally produced piece of curriculum. And lastly, teachers themselves have a lot of discretion in the presentations that they make of their materials, whereas some follow the rules specifically, and a child asks about the use of condoms or whatever, and their school implements abstinence-only education, they just stop talking. They don't say anything. Whereas other teachers, you know, they will go off of the curriculum. So there's a lot of room for discretion in this case. So that's the context. That's where we're working from. For years now, there's been evolution in the use of sex ed in Florida. To kind of talk about why there is an evolution, why there's change or not change, it's useful to look at some policy process models. Like I said, I apologize. I didn't start my clock. There's a calendar on the back wall. Maybe we'll get through this in the next hour. But we have the stages heuristic. We have Eleanor Ostrom. Well, she didn't create institutional rational choice, but she's popularly associated with it. Recent Nobel laureate. The multiple streams framework, punctuated equilibrium, advocacy coalition, and finally, the policy diffusion model. So why am I giving you all of these? Well, because typically the policy diffusion model has been looked at as primarily a descriptive model for explaining why policy does or does not get adopted by different jurisdictions. Whereas what I'm going to suggest today is that it actually has a potential strategic value in addition to just a descriptive value. The stages heuristic. This is your nice linear way of thinking about policy change. First, you identify a problem, problem recognition. In this case, for us, it'll be perhaps we have an uncomfortable amount of single teenage pregnant girls. Or perhaps we have too high an STI rate in our particular district. Whatever the problem might be. That's the recognition. Problem definition. This is an education problem. We can solve this problem with sex ed. Agenda setting. Okay, you have this idea. How are you going to get it on the agenda to be discussed? All right, well, perhaps we're going to do some lobbying, some coalitions, etc. We get it on the agenda. Well, now we have to come up with policy alternatives. Well, what does sex education mean? Like we've seen today, we have four definitions in the state of Florida, and they have to be adopted. Somehow or another, you choose between the policy alternatives by way of policy selection. Then you have to implement the darn thing. And then lastly, evaluation. Is what you're doing actually working? Clearly, policy scholars have a problem with the stages heuristic because it never happens this way. It does not happen in a nice single file form going through the process. So there's some other models. Right now, institutional rational choice is one of the bigger ones, especially in America and Europe, wherein scholars focus on institutional rules and how they affect the behaviors of otherwise rational individuals that are motivated through self-interest. And here we talk about different types of decision-making, whether it's constitutional, collective, or operational. In this case of sex ed, constitutional would just be, well, what's the legal framework? Collective choice, is there the political will to do anything about the situation at hand? And then operational, well, how do we actually create policy to implement in our schools? And whenever we look at this, the scholars have to think about, well, what's the environment? Sex ed systems approach. What are the rules in use? Who are the actors involved? How are we defining things? And lastly, how do these individuals interact with the institutional rules and resources to actually come out with some sort of policy outcome? Multiple streams framework, this is just a fun one. This is Kingdon. He talks about how in America we have incremental policy development. Nothing really happens that big. And there's useful reasons for that. You know, drastic changes produce unpredictability, which doesn't do well for productivity. So we like a nice stable environment. But sometimes there is a big change. And what happens here is you have a policy stream, solutions, looking for problems, some would say. You have a problem stream, and you have a politics stream. And if those three streams don't cross, then nothing happens. For example, in sex ed, let's say the problem stream and the policy stream cross. We identify there's a problem. We have a solution. It's called comprehensive sex ed. Well, at least the advocates would say that. But the policy stream's not crossing. So therefore, we're never going to get the political support to open a window of opportunity to push the policy through. So we have to rely on policy entrepreneurs to try to push and pull the streams so they all cross at one time, and boom, we have policy change. Punctuated equilibrium also works from a basis of incrementalism. And it's similar to policy multiple streams, but here you have policy entrepreneurs trying to create new policy images, reframe the issues, the problems, and the solutions at hand in order to punctuate the incrementalism. Get a big change and then go back into incrementalism. For example, with the ACA, what, did healthcare suddenly become a problem? No. But there was a moment to recontextualize the problem, create a new image, and then sell it. So therefore, we end up with punctuated change. The advocacy coalition framework talks about the interactions between advocacy coalitions. It uses another systems approach, acknowledging the fact that every policy issue has technical information associated with it. Statistics, rules, laws in place, what have you. And there's a variety of institutions that have a say in what's going on here. So therefore, individuals and agencies have to wrestle with their shared and unshared policy beliefs, because you're willing to bend on some of your beliefs. Your rule of thumb beliefs. Okay, yeah, I'll pass that up and I'll accept what you're suggesting. But then agencies and individuals have deep core beliefs. That's just going to be a deal breaker. So we have to somehow modify our coalitions in order to get enough compromise between different partners in order to create policy change through institutional rules, resource allocations, and appointments. Now, why did I bring all that up? Because the policy diffusion model, in my opinion, doesn't work without an understanding of those other models. We're not going to use just one. We have to be sensitive to the utility of the others and the context of here. In policy diffusion, we have this idea of policy change among jurisdictions in an area. As such, policy change is a function of specific political systems characteristics, what they call internal determinants, and various diffusion processes. The idea being that if your neighbor's doing something, you're more inclined to do it too. Here's a quick example. I grew up in the pious, righteous Christian state of South Carolina. To the south of us, we had those heathens, the Georgians. And the Georgians elected, apparently, some representatives in their state government that were just, you know, so scandalous enough that they decided to have a lottery in their state. Legalized gambling, as if, anyway, us South Carolinians, we would have nothing to do with that. We were, like I said, we were a righteous group. Well, it didn't take long to start realizing that we had South Carolina dollars going across the border into Georgia, because apparently there were a few unclean among us that would buy into the Georgia lottery. And we're like, well, wait a minute. We want our South Carolina dollars staying in South Carolina. So guess what we did? We adopted a lottery. So that's an example of policy diffusion in that sort of level. Now, when it comes to policy diffusion and sex ed, there's a couple of things I want to focus on. Regional diffusion model. Whereas at a national level, the governor of California can perhaps be on the phone with the governor from Maine and talk about, oh, what's going on there? How's it working? Okay, blah, blah, blah. Well, that assumes that every jurisdiction has that kind of a communicative relationship with just whoever. But really, the research has found that it happens more in fixed regions and neighbors. The idea being you have more commonality with the people closest to you, particularly the ones right across the border. So in the case of Florida, it's not a hegemonic state. As a matter of fact, before I moved to South Florida, I didn't know there was such a thing as South Florida. But it's an entirely different state than the rest of Florida. A friend of mine from Tallahassee said, everything from just north of Orlando down could fall in the ocean and we would not care. So there's differences in population measures across the state, there's different cultures, and obviously there's different policy adoption. Here's the state of Florida. Back in the early 80s, Pinellas County adopted a form of comprehensive sex education. Nowadays, they haven't really changed much from then, but they were technically the first to do it. But who we all love and care for is St. Lucie. In 2005, their internal determinants, they were experiencing a high rate of teenage pregnancy out of wedlock, and they were concerned about STIs, and not so much HIV, though, And the right coalitions came together at the right time to create policy change. Once again, that's probably the ACF that worked in their particular case. That was 2005. But from 2005 to 2009, it quickly spread. By 2007, we had neighboring state counties that have fully adopted it, but at the same time, from 2007 to 2009, their subsequent neighbors were gradually getting their way into a more comprehensive sex education approach to teaching sex ed. By 2011, you can see once again the neighbor effects coming in, where we have increasing amounts of counties, and then lastly, supposedly Indian River will start doing comprehensive sex ed in 2012. Now, if I were able to have filled in the blocks of the actual counties, it would be more impressive, the connectedness through them, but nevertheless, I think it's representative. All right, so what? What does this all mean? Is this perhaps still descriptive? Well, we already understand that there's different factors explaining variations in sex education policy, whether it be social, cultural, and geographic proximities. What's interesting to point out here is it's not logical. All right? Forget all these statistics-based, logic-driven arguments for policy. Policy doesn't happen that way necessarily. It helps sometimes in some venues, and it doesn't mean anything in other venues. Because there's culture, there's politics, there's passion, there's being human in there as well. So as such, the trick here becomes identifying jurisdictions that are going to be more accepting of the policy change and focus on them. Focus on those of least resistance. Based on one jurisdiction adopting the policy change, in this case, sex ed in St. Lucie County, little by little, by way of neighbors, seeing the effects of what's going on, perhaps improvements. Sometimes it's not even improvements. Sometimes it takes a while for these changes to result in good improvements, but somebody jumped in first, and it's like, oh, that didn't go badly for them. Maybe we can jump in now, too. I've never been skinny dipping, but I'm imagining it's always harder to be the first one jumping in than, say, the fifth person jumping in. Then, obviously, once the ice is broken, perhaps, by advocates facilitating the newly accepted policy, they can potentially diffuse it to the surrounding areas. Now, what's interesting to think about in this case is it kind of plays in with the notion of our understanding of federalism. If you want something done, if you want your state to have comprehensive sex education and the capital doesn't go for it, well, because we have multiple avenues of policy change in our system, drop down to a more local level. If your district doesn't want it, well, go next door. Because based on the research so far, we've found out that that's going to up the percent likelihood of one's own jurisdiction eventually adopting it. So the idea here is there's potentially a strategic payoff for using this model, not for just descriptive understanding, but also for advocating a particular policy topic. Wherein, obviously, it's not going to be just, oh, we have a neighbor that has something, but we have a neighbor that has something, and we can sell the idea based on the environment, the technical information at hand, a group of advocates that are willing to go to bat for it, and lastly, we have to be able to sculpt the conversation with policy images and windows of opportunity. Now, that being said, it's not a part of the presentation today, but just through some exploratory research, I created a database of all the 67 counties with all of the rates of HIV, the crude rate of HIV, the rates of gonorrhea, syphilis, and chlamydia, all combined, the number of pregnancies per single teenage girls, repeat births from single teenage girls, and just for the fun of it, I put in percent that voted Democrat and percent that voted Republican in the 2008 elections, because that was the most recent, and then put in the number of neighbors that have comprehensive sex education. And lo and behold, in a stepwise logistic regression model, the number of neighbors accounts for 18% of variation. The next variable to be entered is the crude rate of HIV, which brings it up to 28. And then lastly, I'm not making this up, percent vote for Democratic jumps it up to 32. That's low for explaining change, but it's still there. So that's something that I hope to bring back to y'all at some other time when I actually have a chance to flesh out the numbers. But regardless, the takeaway here is the idea that although it's typically been descriptive, there's this notion that if you can break into somebody that's willing to listen to you, you can potentially spread the policy across regional or neighbor districts.